really one of the great John Lennon classics of all time. And on the line right now, we have Ken Geringer, who knows as much about John Lennon and these sessions as anybody. And Ken, we appreciate you staying up late tonight.
But you've
been in the music business all your life, so you're not used to going to bed early.
Not a problem. Anyways, let's get back to John and Yoko. I love talking about John and Yoko.
Yeah, now that's interesting. I understand that they had, by reading your book here, they had a kind of a strange relationship. Yoko was actually kind of the boss.
Well, I'll tell you something. I grew up in the 70s, Jerry. And I was I've always been a John Lennon fan. And back then, I even accepted Yoko for a little while. Now, that is until I walked within the Lennon's inner circle after John died. Now, we, meaning the whole world, all believed that John was happily at home for 5 years before he came out to do Double Fantasy, while Yoko went off to work every day. But the sad truth is that John was just very insecure, and he hated dealing with the outside world, while Yoko craved publicity and was just a total control freak.
Yeah, in fact, one of the stories that I found very interesting is the company they got, was it Geffen, David Geffen, that got the contract for Double Fantasy?
Yep.
Yeah, he actually recognized the fact that Yoko Ono was very interested in herself more than John Lennon and really played on that, didn't he?
Well, you know, John could have gotten, he could have named his price for Double Fantasy. He could have gotten millions and millions of dollars more than he got with David Geffen. But David was smart. You know, Ahmet Erdogan, the president of Atlantic Records, and all the big moguls were coming to the studio and trying to make deals with John. But no one wanted to sign Yoko. And David came in, and very, very cleverly, he went up to Yoko and he said to her that, "Yoko, by signing you and John, I won't be getting one recording artist, but I'll be getting two." And that's all she needed to hear. Once she heard that, the deal was done. It didn't matter how much money he was putting up.
Now, tell me that story about sushi in the recording studio and John running into the bathroom and eating McDonald's.
Okay, well, Yoko only allowed sushi in the studio, and there was also a no-alcohol rule. So, and you know, this is how John would disobey her without her ever knowing. It was like a kid disobeying his mother. Once, while John was on the way to the bathroom, he passes the maintenance room at Record Plant, and someone had a pizza in there. So John goes in, and he takes a slice, and he eats it. And from that day on, the maintenance room became a junk food cafeteria, and everyone would just take bathroom breaks whenever Yoko was there, and they'd run into the maintenance room, and they'd stuff a Big Mac down their throat or a slice of pizza. It was hysterical.
Now, who engineered that session?
Lee DiCarlo. Now, speaking of Lee DiCarlo, that's where the no alcohol rule comes in. Now, Lee liked to, he worked with Yoko in the daytime, and that's when John wasn't there, and he liked to drink Jack Daniels, but there was a no alcohol rule. So one day John comes with a potted plant and he brings it into the studio and he puts it right next to Lee's chair, and John takes a flask and he buries it inside the plant, and a little straw sticking out. So now Lee would cough, bend over and sip on it.
Yeah.
And it would be filled with Jack Daniels. So once you know, now the Yoko's catching on, but she never really knows what's going on. The closest she gets to is this. She says to Lee once, "Lee, you have to do something about that cough."
Yeah. Now, I guess Yoko Ono actually wanted to do this this album in Nashville or someplace.
Yeah, well, that's funny, too, because she wanted to do it in Nashville. Now, John was a huge reggae fan. I mean, reggae was just happening. It was coming all over. It was coming all over the place in these late 70s. Bob Marley was still alive, and John wanted to go to Jamaica and be part of that scene. And Yoko said no. She wanted to go to Nashville, so they compromised and settled on New York City.
And that studio was rented, I guess, for months or at least weeks for John Lennon, or did he own part of it, or what? I mean, it seems like you guys were there every day.
Well, no. What happened was John was very insecure, and when he gave Jack the tape of the 12 songs, he wasn't really sure if he was going to come out and do an album. You know, he was thinking that, you know, I'm going to do this, but it's, you know, I know that I have to appear on radio shows and TV shows, and I get butterflies all the time. And John was, the thing about John is he was just a regular guy, you know? He was always afraid to step out into the world and be John Lennon. So anyways,
that's hard to imagine.
Well, when Jack got the it is hard to imagine, but it's true, and Yoko didn't help any, you know, help him at all. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. When Jack got without Yoko approving of them first, and you know how she approved of them?
No.
She had her psychics do numerology or something to approve all Jack's choices.
Wow.
But luckily, she approved them all. So anyways, he hires this incredible band, and he's teaching them the songs that John recorded. And while they're learning the song, Jax becomes the singer, and he starts singing them. And these guys are getting paid like triple scale, and they have no idea they're working on a John Lennon album. So one day the band gets together, and they sit Jack down, and they say, Jack, we've all come to this conclusion that these songs are great, and we love working with you, and we love the money, but we just don't think your vocals are going to cut it.
In other words, you can't sing.
They thought Jack was the artist for a while.
Yeah, we're talking about record producer Jack Douglas. Ken, I want you to say hello to disc jockey here at the station, Scott Simon, who has his own Beatles website and knows quite a lot about the Beatles and one of their biggest fans, and, of course, a John Lennon fan. Scott, say hello to Ken.
Ken, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm pretty good out here.
Ken, I was wanting to ask a couple of questions of you just to see if Jack had said anything about this. There's a big mystery over whether, well, it's a fact that they were. Apparently, the Double Fantasy sessions were videotaped, which would have been some of the last video shot of John. But unfortunately, it seems the videos have just vanished over the years.
Yeah, well, I'll forget about the video, because Yoko got a hold of that. And you know who did that video? The guy produced all the, were you ever in New York in the 80s? There was these wild commercials called Crazy Eddie, where the guy would scream and he goes, price is unbelievable.
The appliance,
Yeah. Well, the guy who did all that stuff, which was famous in New York City, videotaped the sessions. And I think some of the tape came out, but I think most of it went to Yoko. But I got a better one for you. You're going to love this. You know, during the sessions, when the music started to, when John was seeing how the music was coming out, he was starting to relax. And at the end of the sessions, when everyone left, Jack, Lee DiCarlo, and John would hang out at Record Plant. And John would put his feet on the console, and he'd light a joint, and he'd start talking. He'd talk about the old days, and he'd tell Jack how they did this part in a record with George Martin, and he just would go on and on and on. And Jack knew that hey, this is special. So he wanted to give John a gift. So what he did is, without John knowing, and John never knew about this, he hid microphones in the room. And when John would start talking, he'd turn them on, and he was recording these conversations. And he said he recorded hours and hours. It was just like a history of the Beatles, John was telling these guys. And he was also saying things like he was going to leave Yoko, and, you know, and just all about the future plans they were making. But John died, and Jack had these tapes, and he really didn't know what to do with them. So he put them in a box, and sadly, he handed them over to Yoko. And wow. They've never reappeared.
Wow. I wonder why she wouldn't want things like this out, do you? Does anybody have any idea why she wouldn't?
Yeah, because she doesn't, you know, she doesn't care about John. She cares about what's it going to do for her. John talking about not being satisfied is not going to do anything for her career.
Now, what did, I wonder during these tapes of John, or during the sessions at all, ever aired his feelings about one of his other partners, Paul McCartney?
Well, I got a little insight about that, and Scott may too. You know, Scott, are you there? You know, John, if you've ever... Scott, are you a musician?
Actually, I am, yes.
Okay, so you've been in bands before.
Sure.
Think back to your first band.
Okay.
Now, everyone loved their first band. The Beatles was like John's first band. That was his baby. He loved the Beatles, and he loved his bandmates. He loved all those guys. That was just the media that did that.
Interesting point there.
Now, Anyways, Jack told me a story that he was in the studio with John when the news came that Paul got arrested in Japan for having pot. Do you remember when that happened?
Oh, yeah, that was 1980, during those sessions.
Yes,
Robin.
Yes. They got the news. Now, the media ran around saying how John was laughing about it and he was making fun of Paul. Do you know the truth? I don't think anyone knows that.
Yeah,
John,
how'd you hear it?
John flipped out. He went berserk. He was scared that Paul was in trouble. He commanded Yoko to call her uncle, who is a politician in Japan, and start working on the case and doing whatever they could do to help Paul. Now, that's the kind of guy John was. And as far as Ringo goes, that was like his younger brother. You know, on the cassette tape that I own this cassette tape, the original Bermuda tape. On that cassette tape, John earmarks a song for Ringo. He goes, "This one's for Richard Starkey, late of the Beatles. This one's for Ringo. This one's got to be for Ringo." You guys know what that song was?
No.
It was Nobody Told Me.
Wow.
So that was supposed to have gone to Ringo, but after John died, Yoko recorded that on Milk and Honey.
Yeah, and in fact, that's what we opened the show with, as you know. You had some other interesting insights about Yoko Ono, in that she wasn't John Lennon's friend. A little earlier, you were talking about some of the things. You said, I'll get back to that later. You remember what we were talking about, Ken Geringer, when we were talking about Yoko, that she was not necessarily his biggest booster, as everybody was led to believe.
Well, let me start by saying she comes from a different culture. And in her culture, she came from a very royal family in Japan. And most people that she had come in contact with in her life, even when she was an artist before she met John, she thought that they were beneath her. And she's always felt that way. And guys like the Beatles, it didn't matter what their merits were or who they were, she always felt like she was the royal one. And, you know, I think she looked down on all of them just because it was a cultural thing. Now, as far as her relationship with John, I mean, I've come to the conclusion that, well, let me say first that John loved Yoko. John loved her, but I don't think he loved her in the correct manner. I think he loved her more like a mother. When Yoko came up with a song that she was working on, John hired Jack Douglas, he hired the best arrangers, anything for her, because he wanted her to have great music. He wanted everything that she did to be successful. But she, on the other hand, never really cared about what John was doing. She never, like, took an interest in his music, or she used to tell him that, you know, you'll never be able to create music like you did in the past. What she did is she helped keep him hidden instead of bringing him out. And, you know, it's really sad that that's the girl that John picked.
Now, on the Double Fantasy album, we're going to play a cut here, and then we'll be back to talk to you a little bit more. I guess Yoko Ono pretty much insisted that she be on this this session, or was this John's idea?
I think she took control that she was going to be there, but, you know, I think John just wanted to do anything he could to make her successful.
We're going to play, Scott, what cut we're going to play here, you think, fits?
Actually, we're going to play the debut single from Just Like Starting Over. Would have been John's first hit in many years, and I'm going to wonder afterwards, Ken, you know, how proud was he of this going up the charts?
Well, I imagine he was pretty proud, didn't he?
He was thrilled.
Yeah, he had to be.
I'll tell you what his plans were after this.
Good. Well, stick around, Ken. We'll be right back.
Life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere. Time flies so quickly.
take us alone? Take a trip somewhere far, far away.